I've been a member of the Masters Mates and Pilots since 1992, and up until now, we've never rejected a tentative agreement.
Marine highway workers say no to a new contract with the state. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, firefighters from interior villages head to the lower 48 to work on wildfire crews.
Sort of nervous, like I don't even know what I'm going to be doing out there, but I don't know, I'm ready to go.
Have you ever left Alaska before?
Nope, it's been my first time.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by ExxonMobil Alaska, where more than 1,000 Alaskan men and women are working on the Point Thompson project, proving energy lives here.
In the U.S. Senate race, Dan Sullivan's financial advantage over other Republican contenders continues to grow. Sullivan has raised more than $4 million, most from outside Alaska. He's done well in Ohio, the headquarters of the paint company his family runs. Money has also poured into the Sullivan campaign from national fundraising groups working to win Republican control of the Senate. A separate group led by Alaska ad man Art Hackney is running its own pro-Sullivan ads. The Hackney Super PAC has raised nearly $500,000. Most of that has come from Sullivan's parents and brother in Ohio, who added $300,000 to the fund last month. Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell is running a distant second, with contributions hovering around the $1 million mark. He has also loaned the campaign $250,000 of his own money. Joe Miller's campaign is running on about $300,000. Senator Mark Begich, a Democrat, has no opposition in the primary. He's raised more than $6 million. The licensed captains and officers who navigate Alaska Marine Highway System vessels have rejected a tentative contract agreement with the state. KTOO's Casey Kelly reports.
The International Organization of Masters, Mates, and Pilots voted down the proposal by mail-in ballot. Union Representative Ron Brissett says the votes were counted last week.
I've been a member of the Masters, Mates, and Pilots since 1992, worked out on the ferries myself, and up until now, we've never rejected a tentative agreement. So this is a first for me.
Brissett declined to say whether the vote was close or if an overwhelming majority of members were opposed to the deal. MMP represents about 100 Alaska Marine Highway workers, including captains, chief, second, and third mates, and pilots. Union leaders had recommended approval of the deal reached June 29th, a day before the workers' old contract expired. Brissett says many members were frustrated that the agreement included no pay increase in the first year, a 1% raise in 2015, and a 2% increase in 2016. Second mates would also get a 3% raise in year two.
They feel that the wage increases that we negotiated were not adequate.
Brissett hopes to meet with state officials Friday to discuss what to do next. Options range from negotiating a new agreement to binding arbitration. He won't rule out members going on strike.
We're making the preliminary steps to be ready to go on strike, you know, start the planning process, and that option is available to us.
Alaska Department of Administration spokesman Andy Mills says the state's negotiating team is looking forward to hearing union members' concerns and figuring out the best way forward.
Obviously, when both sides are having a negotiation at the table, I don't think that either side takes anything completely off the table, but I don't actually believe we're that far apart. It's about polling the members and finding out what are those differences.
The other two unions representing Alaska ferry workers also have tentative agreements with the state. The Inland Boatmen's Union of the Pacific will tally its members' votes on August 26th. The Marine Engineers Beneficial Association has not yet mailed ballots to its members. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
More than 300 firefighters from across Alaska are in California battling wildfires for at least the next 2 weeks. Most of them traveled from interior Alaska villages, and as KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, for some, it was the first time they've left the state.
For the last week, huge jets have taken off from a runway at Fort Wainwright. K carrying loads of Type 1 and Type 2 firefighting crews south. Adolf McGinty is the crew representative for 19 other firefighters that are currently fighting a blaze in California's Klamath National Forest.
Holy cow, that's a big responsibility, but it's really good. You know, it's really good to watch over, watch these guys work along with them.
McGinty was born and raised in Caltag, a small village that lies along the bank of the Yukon River.
Yeah, I've been doing this for 28 years, fighting fire, yeah.
He knows his crew extremely well. As he talks about the various fires he's fought, he shoots a glance and a smile at Albert Nikolai.
Well, we're classmates.
All these firefighters come through Fairbanks from interior villages like Nalato, Galena, Vinatai, and Koyukuk for a briefing at the Alaska Fire Service headquarters. But no one here is in a particularly serious mood. They're all laughing, smiling, and joking. Adolf McGinty says that's because they all know each other.
When I do sign a crew up in Caltech, gee, I got assignment just about my brothers, my uncles, all my relatives, you know. Everybody's my family, and you know, there's just no way around it.
In fact, says Albert Nikolai, that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's easier when you know other people, even on the other crews. Because you can trust him.
Nikolai's 18-year-old son, Kyle, stands nearby. This is his rookie year fighting fires.
Sort of nervous. Like, I don't even know what I'm going to be doing out there, but I don't know. I'm ready to go.
Have you ever left Alaska before?
Nope. It's been my first time.
So what are you looking forward to?
I don't know. Just seeing what it's like out there. See how big it is compared to here.
For many of the interior's Alaska Native crews, it's one of the few opportunities they have to travel outside the state. 55-year-old Dennis Eric is from Vinatai. He first traveled to Idaho to fight fire in the mid-1990s.
It was pretty amazing. We went down in June, and it was pretty light up here, you know. The sky was light up, but when we went down there, we didn't know it. You know, it just got dark. 9 o'clock. It seemed like fall time for me.
Summertime darkness is only one of the things Cato Howard touches on during a safety briefing with crews. Howard's the operations section chief for the Alaska Fire Service. He also warns everyone about poison oak. It's a plant that doesn't grow in Alaska, and it can cause a nasty, itchy rash.
Then sometimes the whole crew gets into it, and that it depends. These guys have never run into it. They're going to find out if they're allergic to it or not. And unfortunately, it's uncomfortable in that temperature.
Crews face average daytime temperatures in the 90s, well above what anyone normally sees in Alaska this time of year. That's why Howard emphasizes hydration during his briefing.
Yeah, well, they drink a lot of coffee, and they drink a lot of pop, and they drink a lot of Gatorade, and that's a natural habit for them. But that habit, you can't do that habit out there. It'll tear you up. And what, you know, most of these will run into is either dehydration or heat illnesses.
So that won't surprise you if you get, you know, one guy that might get
it. It doesn't surprise me when we send anybody from Alaska down there, even our own agency crews, and somebody gets heat illness.
The heat, allergic reactions, and dangerous, steep and rocky terrain doesn't seem to be a problem for Dennis Eric. Instead, he says it's kind of like a paid vacation.
What do you do at home?
Fishing, hunting, you know, duck hunting. Oh, you know, it's not sport fishing, you know, it's for food.
Eric expects to bring home anywhere between $3,000 and $5,000 for 2 weeks of firefighting in California. That's well beyond what he can make in the same amount of time in Vinatai. He jokes about how happy his family is to see him leave.
They're probably making a wish, making a list, kicking it twice, probably. I hope it's good. I hope it's a little cheaper.
Eric plans to be in California for at least 2 weeks, but he and the rest of his crew could be sent to other fires burning in Oregon and other western states. But once the fire season dies down, they'll all return to Alaska with stories to share amongst each other. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Roman Dial says he needs help finding his son missing in the jungle in Costa Rica.
We're not asking for helicopters. We're not asking for, you know, any military. We're just asking for well-trained special forces, a small team.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
On Tuesday, voters will decide which Republican candidate will face off against Mark Begich in a closely watched Senate primary. But while it's gotten less attention, there's also a contested statewide race on the Democratic ballot for the office of lieutenant governor. One of the two candidates is Hollis French, a state senator who is giving up his seat in the legislature to run for the job. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez has this profile.
Nice to meet you, Brian. Great support over the years out of the plumbers and pipe fitters. I want to come out and show a little support.
Thank you. Awesome.
Bet. I'm running for lieutenant governor.
Nice.
So let me give you a card.
It's 2 days into the NSTAR labor strikes and 7 days from the primary election, and Hollis French is going picketing. But he's campaigning, too. This will be French's sixth time running for office, with most of those races to keep his Senate seat. In 2010, he ran for governor but lost in the Democratic primary. Last year, he decided not to run for re-election to his Senate seat and instead considered another run for governor. He even put in paperwork and had signs made. But he wasn't the only one who wanted the job, so he dropped down to the second-ranking seat in the executive branch.
You know, I couldn't see going through a destructive primary with Byron Mallott. That didn't make sense. I respect him. I think he's got a broader reach.
The lieutenant governor job isn't a terribly powerful one. The office oversees the Division of Elections, signs regulations, protects the state seal, and can help counsel the governor. But mostly, it puts you next in line to run the state should anything happen. French says, even so, he'd rather try for the executive branch than the legislature at this point.
If you really want to make a change, that's the place to do it, and probably not inside the legislature.
For much of his time in office, French was part of the ruling caucus. As a member of the Senate bipartisan coalition, he chaired committees and actually had the power to move legislation through the body. French gets a little nostalgic about it.
The coalition was really a godsend, and it was a big leap for me. I mean, we shook hands with people that, I had been diametrically opposed to and fighting for the last 4 years.
The coalition fell apart in 2012 when a mix of Democrats and moderate Republicans were voted out of office after new redistricting maps came out. Put in a more conservative district, French barely held on to his seat, winning by just 51 votes. The Republican, State Representative Mia Costello, running in the West Anchorage district he represents, is even stronger than the opponent he faced last time. But while she was initially viewed as difficult to beat, the Democrat who ended up filing in the district, Claire Ross, has been one of the top fundraisers this year. Even though that race is now considered competitive, French says he doesn't regret not defending his seat.
None of us are irreplaceable. I have really enjoyed my time there, but it really feels like I've made the right decision.
Now, French is running against teacher and political newcomer Bob Williams to make up the bottom half of a gubernatorial ticket. Should French win the primary, the show won't be about him in November. And even if he does end up on the ticket, it's a tough race for the Democrats against Republican Governor Sean Parnell. On top of Parnell's incumbency advantage and the conservative tilt in the state, it's also a three-way race with independent candidate Bill Walker pulling from the same demographic as Mallott. French thinks that Parnell can be beat, though, especially if the oil tax referendum passes next week. But if he does lose the primary or the general, French says he's okay if this turns out to be the end of his political career.
You know, we're not going to starve to death. I have a law degree. I can practice law. There's great mountains out there. I like to climb mountains. there's all kinds of stuff to do.
And plus, he says, in this state, old politicians never really disappear. In Anchorage, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The million-dollar steel float in the southeast community of Gustavus was less than 2 years old when a storm ripped it from its piling in January. 7 months later, the state still doesn't know what caused the failure and doesn't have funds to replace it. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
When the state installed the all-weather float in the fall of 2012, the purpose was to provide additional moorage opportunity for Gustavus boaters in the summer. The plan was to keep it in the water during the winter, even though it wouldn't be used. Kirk Miller supervises marine design in Southeast for the Alaska Department of Transportation. He says the 200-foot float was built to be easily removed from its piles.
We knew from day one that this environment out here might not allow this float to survive.
Miller says his design team is very familiar with the severe storm weather at the Gustavus Harbor facility. It's in an exposed section of land that gets strong winds blowing from the west.
The intent was to watch this closely, and if it looked like we were going to have issues, we would unbolt this thing and put it up the Salmon River where we did the rest of the floats every year.
A storm in mid-December damaged 5 of the 10 steel piles holding the float in place.
After that first storm, we should have been out there unbolting it ourselves.
But, Miller says, the state didn't move fast enough.
While we were formulating a plan to replace the piles, the next storm came up. You know, I wish we would have taken it out, but we didn't.
Miller admits that was a mistake, but says the design of the float and the pilings holding it in place was not. He says DOT has done a lot of analysis since the January storm.
We've also analyzed our original design calculations, and we've determined that the loads of those two storms in December and January that were imposed on those piles were higher than we originally anticipated.
Data from a state weather gauge at the harbor facility and statistical models have led Miller to believe waves were as high as 10 to 12 feet. Still, he says, the piles should have survived.
We still do not have a firm grasp on the actual failure mechanism.
The steel float was salvaged and is now anchored across Icy Passage near Pleasant Island. Miller says it's in relatively good shape. The remains of the steel pilings were removed. Without the steel float, commercial and recreational boaters have been sharing 350 feet of timber floats in the Gustavus Harbor. The state paid about $30,000 to rebuild two sections of it that had been destroyed in the January storm. Those were just replaced in mid-July. Gustavus tour operator Todd Sieben says without the steel float, space is tight.
You really have to get in, kind of get your people, and get out.
Sieben runs a 50-foot whale-watching boat, the Taz, which can carry up to 28 passengers. He offers two trips daily.
But people have actually been working well together, the charter fishermen, some of the commercial fishermen, and some of the individual tour operators like myself. Everybody's been really considerate this year.
Mayor Sandy Marchbanks says Gustavus residents and business owners are used to making do with what's available. But, she says, the town does need the steel float and hopes the state will replace it as soon as possible. Miller says the state doesn't have the funding to do that.
It is our hope to bring that float back to the harbor, but nothing is certain.
The state does have close to $4.5 million in federal aid for a different Gustavus project. Miller says the state plans to replace the floating transfer bridge in the Alaska Marine Highway facility with a cable lift system.
We may incorporate some elements of that steel float back into that project, but we don't know if the federal government will participate in that because they paid for it once and it broke loose, and I don't know if they'll participate again.
If DOT does reinstate the steel float in Gustavus, it would be in a seasonal capacity only. Like the other harbor floats, it would have to be kept in the Salmon River during the winter and brought back out in the summer. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable contributions. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
Almost 2 weeks ago, 27-year-old Alaskan Cody Dial was reported missing on a kayak trip in Costa Rica. Dial is the son of Roman Dial, a well-known outdoorsman and Alaska Pacific University professor. In a call from Costa Rica yesterday, the elder Dial says the search for his son has turned up nothing so far, and that requests for help from the U.S. by the Costa Rican government have not been answered. Dial has asked that Alaska's congressional delegation put pressure on U.S. officials to help. He says the process has stalled in bureaucratic, heavy Washington, D.C.
So, you know, the Costa Rican government had to request help, and they had to request it through the State Department. And then the State Department has to pass it all the way up to the top, you know, to the Secretary of State. And then the Secretary of State hands it over to the Department of Defense, and then over to the Secretary of Defense. And then the Secretary of Defense, somehow it kind of has to trickle down to the right place and then sort of snap into place and catch, so that the whole process moves. But it's been over a week and there's nothing happening.
Dial says the Costa Rican Red Cross, which has been assisting in the search since August 1st, decided to pull out of the rescue effort about a week ago. Dial says with a few experts in climbing and jungle living, he believes his son can be located.
We're not asking for helicopters. We're not asking for, you know, any military. We're just asking for well-trained special forces, a small team of, you know, 6 to 10 people with rope and the skills to explore these jungle canyons for about a week. And that's what we're asking for.
Dial thinks his son is in a dangerous area of Costa Rica's Corcovado National Park. The area is so hazardous, it's off limits to tourists. Roman Dial's wife, Peggy, says Cody left Anchorage in December, bound for Mexico and Central America. She says her son is cautious and capable and kept in touch with his parents through regular email and phone updates until the messages stopped coming in mid-July. Three Army units were inactivated this afternoon at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. The move is a result of changing priorities and fiscal belt tightening at the federal level. KSKA's Monica Goki has more.
The 56th Engineer Company, 84th Engineer Supply Company, and the 240th Survey and Design Detachment have fought in every conflict since World War II. All three Army units had their colors cased this afternoon at J-Bear, rendering them out of service until they're needed again.
Detachment are hereby inactivated.
Battalion Commander George Walter says seeing the units and their rich histories get shelved is bittersweet, but he also says it's a necessity.
These changes are designed to allow our Army to retain its adaptability and flexibility in order to address future and unknown challenges. As soldiers, we know it's really not a matter of if we go to war next, it is a matter of when we go to war next.
Army units come and go as the nation's conflicts change, but these three are being inactivated due to budget cuts. And calling the units inactivated doesn't mean soldiers will lose their jobs. Walter says most will be reshuffled within the Army.
Most of the great soldiers of the 84th, 56th, and 240th, who've elected through their individual career paths to continue serving, will be reassigned both here within Alaska and across our great Army.
At a national level, the Army is reducing its active force by about 15%, or 80,000 soldiers. In Alaska, the reduction numbers about 400 individuals, according to Army Alaska Media Chief John Pinnell.
J-Bear will lose roughly 800, but there will be a plus up of some at Fort Wainwright.
The cuts are small compared to what some other Army posts are experiencing. Elsewhere in the country, cuts are numbering in the thousands, Pinnell says.
We figure we're doing pretty well here in Alaska, getting by with the small number of cuts that we'll be taking, and it shows the importance of Alaska strategically for the military and the value that the Army puts on Alaska.
One more Army unit is slated for inactivation later this month. The 793rd Military Police Battalion will stand down after more than 70 years of service. The unit was a part of the Red Ball Express during World War II, an effort that supplied Allied forces in Europe from the beach at Normandy. In Anchorage, I'm Monica Goki.
In Talkeetna, a writer is looking to hitch a ride to Point Barrow, but she doesn't want to go by ground transportation. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
At KTNA, we often have people contact us asking for help finding a ride. Normally, it's someone needing to get to town for an appointment or looking for a ride to the airport. On Wednesday, a very different kind of ride seeker walked through our doors.
So you're
hitchhiking by plane and trying to reach all 50 states?
Yes.
That's Amber Nolan. She's a travel writer who's been hitching rides on private aircraft for the better part of 2 years. Her goal for this leg of her journey is to make it from Key West, Florida to Point Barrow, Alaska. Amber says that her work has taken her all over the world, but she had not seen as much of America as she would like, so she decided to start traveling.
One thing led to another, and this idea came up to do it and hitchhike across the U.S. by general aviation, because I thought it'd be an interesting viewpoint and perspective on the U.S. And also, when you're landing at small airports, it gives you an entirely kind of different angle to go at. You're not flying into big cities. You get to see the small town U.S. instead of just the major tourist point.
Hitchhiking is relatively common in Alaska. For most people, it means standing along the side of the road with a thumb in the air and sometimes a sign with the destination on it. With airplanes, things work differently. Amber Nolan says the initial reaction she gets is often one of surprise.
Well, I usually go in and just tell whoever's working at the FBO or just in the airport what I'm doing, and usually I get, wait, what? What are you doing? and then kind of the weird eyes of, are you crazy? And then after a minute, they kind of understand that I'm on this adventure.
Word then spreads among the local pilot community, and when someone is willing to give Amber a ride in roughly the right direction, she hops on board. In small towns where only a few planes come in and out on a given day, that can take a while. Other times, Murphy's Law rears its head and causes even longer delays.
Yeah, I've been in Texas. I got stuck at for quite a few weeks because one thing led to another. The rain came in, problems with an airplane, and so it seemed like I had four different people that offered to give me a ride, and something went wrong every time.
Amber says some of her flights have been particularly memorable, including one on a former warplane.
I got to hitchhike on a B-17, which was just epic. I mean, I couldn't get the grin off my face the entire flight.
Where was that?
From Indiana. They were doing a kind of barnstorming tour. Mm-hmm. So they were going from town to town doing scenic flights, and people would make reservations and do the flight. And I said, well, what about between towns? And I was like, do you have any room on those flights? And he goes, well, the whole plane's empty if you want to go.
With clouds in the forecast, Amber anticipates waiting a few days until Talkeetna. It probably won't be long, though, until she's on her way north once more. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly and Lisa Fu in Juneau, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer and Monica Goki in Anchorage, and Philip Manning in Talkeetna. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez and Liz Ruskin also reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Doy Unlimited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized John Deere dealer. The Anchorage location just behind the Ship Creek Salmon Fishing offers a wide range of John Deere compact tractors. CraigTaylorEquipment.com. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.